me a nasty cut on my upper arm. But then, suddenly, the front door was thrown open, and they both disappeared into the night, still reeling like drunks. My hands were trembling so much, I could hardly manage to bolt the door. I leaned against it and listened for sounds outside, but all I heard was my own racing heart. Then I heard you crying in the living room, and remembered that there had been a third man. I staggered back, still holding the sword, and there stood Dustfinger in the middle of the room. He had no weapon, just the marten sitting on his shoulders. He flinched, face white as a sheet, when I came toward him. I must have been a terrible sight, with the blood running down my arm, and I was shaking all over, whether from fear or anger I couldn't have said. "Please," he kept whispering, "don't kill me. I have nothing to do with those two. I'm only a juggler, just a harmless fire-eater, I can show you." And I said, "Yes, yes, all right, I know who you are. You're Dustfinger. I even know your name, you see?" At which he cowered in awe before me, a magician, he thought, who seemed to know all about him and who had plucked him out of his world as easily as picking an apple off a tree. The marten scampered along his arm, jumped down on the carpet and ran toward you. You stopped crying and put out your hand. "Careful, he bites," said Dustfinger, shooing him away from you. I took no notice. I suddenly realized how quiet the room was, that was all. How quiet, and how empty. I saw the book lying open on the carpet where I had dropped it, and I saw the cushion where your mother had been sitting. And she wasn't there. Where was she? I called her name again and again. I ran from room to room. But she had gone. Eleanor was sitting bolt upright, staring at him in horror. "For heaven's sake, Mortimer, what are you saying?" she cried. "You told me she went away on some stupid adventure holiday and never came back." Mo leaned his head against the wall. "I had to think up something, Eleanor," he said. "I mean, I could hardly tell the truth, could I?" Maggie stroked his arm where his shirt hid the long pale scar. "You always told me you'd cut your arm climbing through a broken window." "Yes, I know. The truth would have sounded too crazy, don't you think?" Maggie nodded. He was right. She would just have thought it was another of his stories.
"So she never came back," she whispered,
although she knew the answer already. "No," replied Mo softly. "Buster, Capricorn, and Dustfinger came out of the book, and she went into it, along with our two cats who were curled up on her lap as usual while I read aloud. I expect some creature from here changed places with Gwyn, too, maybe a spider or a fly or a bird that happened to be flying around the house. Oh, I don't know." Mo fell silent. Sometimes, when he had made up such a good story that Maggie thought it was true, he would suddenly smile and say, "You fell for that one, Maggie." Like the time on her 7th birthday, when he told her he'd seen fairies among the crocuses in the garden. But the smile didn't come this time. "I searched the whole house for your mother. No sign of her," he went on. "And when I came back to the living room, Dustfinger had vanished, and so had his friend with the horns. But the sword was still there, and it felt so real that I decided not to doubt my sanity. I put you to bed. I think I told you your mother had already gone to sleep. Then I began reading Inkheart out loud again. I read the whole damn book until I was hoarse and the sun was rising, but nothing came out of it except a bat and a silken cloak, which I used later to line your book box. I tried again and again during the days and nights that followed, until my eyes were burning, and the letters danced drunkenly on the page. I didn't eat, I didn't sleep. I kept making up different stories for you to explain where your mother was, and I took good care you were never in the room with me when I was reading aloud, in case you disappeared too. I wasn't worried about myself. Oddly enough, I had a feeling that the person reading the book ran no risk of slipping into its pages. I still don't know whether I was right." Mo flicked a midge off his hand. "I read until I couldn't hear my own voice anymore," he went on. But your mother didn't come back, Maggie. Instead, a strange little man, as transparent as if he were made of glass, appeared in my living room on the fifth day, and the mailman disappeared just as he was putting the mail into our mailbox. I found his bike out in the yard. After that, I knew that neither walls nor locked doors would keep you safe, you or anybody else. So I decided never to read aloud from a book again. Not from Inkheart, nor from any other book.
"What happened to the little glass man?" asked Maggie.
Mo sighed. "He broke into pieces only a few days later when a heavy truck drove past the house. Obviously very few creatures move easily from one world to another. We both know what fun it can be to get right into a book and live there for a while, but falling out of a story and suddenly finding yourself in this world doesn't seem to be much fun at all. It broke Dustfinger's heart."
"Oh, he has a heart, does he?" inquired Eleanor bitterly.
"It would be better for him if he didn't," replied Mo. More than a week passed before he was back at my door again. It was night, of course. He prefers night to day. I was just packing. I decided it was safer to leave, since I didn't want to be driving Buster and Capricorn out of my house at Sword Point again. Dustfinger's reappearance showed that I was right to feel anxious. It was well after midnight when he turned up, but I couldn't sleep anyway. Mo stroked Maggie's hair. "You weren't sleeping well then either. You had bad dreams, however much I tried to keep them away from my stories. I was just packing the tools in my workshop when there was a knock on the front door, a very soft, almost furtive knock. Dustfinger emerged from the dark as suddenly as he did when he came to our house 4 days ago. Heavens, was it really only 4 days? Well, when he came back that first time, he looked as if it had been too long since he'd eaten. He was thin as a stray cat, and his eyes were dull. 'Send me back,' he begged. 'Send me back. This world will be the death of me. It's too fast, too crowded, too noisy. If I don't die of homesickness, I shall starve to death. I don't know how to make a living. I don't know anything. I'm like a fish out of water,' he said. And he refused to believe that I couldn't do it. He wanted to see the book and try for himself, even though he could scarcely read. But there was no way I could let him have it. It would have been like giving away the very last part I still had of your mother. Luckily, I'd hidden it well. I let Dustfinger sleep on the sofa, and came down the next morning to find him still searching the bookshelves. Over the next few years, he kept on turning up, following us wherever we went, until I got sick and tired of it, and made off with you in secret, like a thief in the night. After that, I saw no more of him for 5 years. Until 4 days ago."
Maggie looked at him. "You still feel sorry for him," she said. Mo was silent. At last he said, "Sometimes." Eleanor's comment on that was a snort of contempt.
"You're even crazier than I thought," she said. "It's that idiot's fault we're in this hole. It's his fault if they cut our throats, and you still feel sorry for him?"
Mo shrugged his shoulders and looked up at the ceiling, where a few moths were fluttering around the naked light bulb.
"No doubt Capricorn has promised to take him back," he said. "Unlike me, he realized that Dustfinger would do anything in return for such a promise. All he wants is to go back to his own world. He doesn't even stop to ask if his story there has a happy ending."
"Well, that's no different from real life," remarked Eleanor gloomily. "You never know if things will turn out well. Just now our own story looks like it's coming to a bad end."
Maggie sat with her arms clasped around her legs, her chin on her knees, staring at the dirty white walls. In her mind's eye she saw the N in front of her, the N with the horned marten sitting on it, and she felt as if her mother were looking out from beyond the big capital letter. Her mother, as she was in the faded photograph under Mo's pillow. So she hadn't run away after all. Did she like it in that other world? Did she still remember her daughter? Or were Maggie and Mo just a fading picture for her, too?
Did she long to be back in her old world, just as Dustfinger did? And did Capricorn long to be back in his own world as well? Was that what he wanted, for Mo to read him back again? What would happen when Capricorn realized that Mo simply couldn't do it? Meggy shuddered.
It seems Capricorn has someone else to read aloud to him now, Mo went on, as if he had guessed her thoughts. Buster told me about the man, probably to show me I'm not by any means indispensable. Apparently he's read several useful assistants for Capricorn out of a book already. Oh, yes? Then why does he want you?
Eleanor sat up, rubbing her behind and groaning.
I don't understand any of this. I just hope it's all a bad dream, the kind you wake up from with a stiff neck and a bad taste in your mouth.
Meggy doubted whether Eleanor really had any such hope. The damp straw felt too real, and so did the cold wall behind them. She leaned against Mo's shoulder again and closed her eyes. She was very sorry she had scarcely read a line of Inkheart. She knew nothing at all about the story into which her mother had disappeared. All she knew was Mo's other stories about the fabulous exploits that had kept her mother away, tales of the adventures she was having in distant lands, of fearsome enemies who kept preventing her from coming home, and of a box she was filling for Meggy, putting something new and wonderful in it at every enchanted place she visited.
Mo, she asked, do you think she likes being in that story?
It took Mo quite a long time to answer.
She'd certainly like the fairies, he said at last. Although they're deceitful little things, and if I know her, she'll be putting out bowls of milk for the goblins. Yes, I think she'd like that part of it.
So what wouldn't she like?
Meggy looked at him anxiously. Mo hesitated. The evil in it, he finally said.
So many bad things happen in that book, and she never found out that it all ends reasonably well. After all, I never finished reading her the whole story. That's what she wouldn't like. No, of course not, said Eleanor. But how do you know the story hasn't changed anyway? After you read Capricorn and his friend out of it, and now we're stuck with them here.
Yes, said Mo.
But they're still in the book, too. Believe me, I've read it often enough since they came out of it, and the story's still about them, Dustfinger, Buster, and Capricorn. Doesn't that mean everything is still the way it was? Capricorn is still there, and we're only up against a shadow of him in this world. He's pretty frightening for a shadow, said Eleanor.
Yes, you're right, agreed Mo.
Perhaps things have changed there, after all. Perhaps there's another, much larger story behind the printed one. A story that changes, just as our own world does. And the letters on the page tell us only as much as we'd see peering through a keyhole. Perhaps the story in the book is just the lid on a pan. It always stays the same, but underneath there's a whole world that goes on, developing and changing, like our own world. Eleanor groaned. For heaven's sake, Mortimer, she said. Stop it, please. You're giving me a headache.
It made my own head ache when I tried to make sense of it all, replied Mo gloomily. After that, they said nothing for quite a long time, all three of them absorbed in their own thoughts. Eleanor was the first to speak again, although it sounded almost as if she were talking to herself.
"Heavens above," she murmured, taking off her shoes, "to think of all the times I've wished I could slip right into one of my favourite books. But that's the advantage of reading. You can shut the book whenever you want."
Groaning, she wriggled her toes and began walking up and down. Meggy had to suppress a giggle. Eleanor looked so funny, hobbling from the wall to the door and back again, with her aching feet, back and forth like a clockwork toy.
"Eleanor, you're driving me bonkers. Please sit down again," said Mo. "No, I won't," she snapped back. "I'll go mad myself if I stay sitting down."
Mo made a face and put his arm around Meggy's shoulders.
"All right, let's leave her to it," he whispered. "By the time she's covered 10 kilometres, she'll fall down exhausted. But you ought to get some sleep now. You can have my bed. It's not as bad as it looks."
If you close your eyes very tight, you can imagine your Wilbur the pig sleeping comfortably in his sty.
Or Wart sleeping in the grass with the wild geese.
Maggie couldn't help yawning. How often she and Mo had played this game. Which book can you think of? Which part have we forgotten? Oh, yes, that one. It's ages since I thought about that story. Wearily, she lay down on the prickly straw. Mo pulled off his sweater over his head and covered her up with it.
You need a blanket all the same, he said, even if you're a pig or a goose.
But you'll freeze.
Nonsense.
And where will you and Eleanor sleep?
Maggie yawned again. She hadn't realized how tired she was. Eleanor was still pacing from wall to wall.
What's all this about sleeping? She said. We're going to keep watch, of course.
All right, murmured Maggie,
burying her nose in Mo's sweater. He's back with me, she thought, as drowsiness weighed down her eyelids. Nothing else matters. And then she thought, oh, if only I could read some more of that book. But Inkheart was in Capricorn's hands, and she didn't want to think of him now, or she would never get to sleep. Never. Later, she didn't know how long she had slept. Perhaps her cold feet woke her, or the itchy straw under her head. Her watch said 4 o'clock. There was nothing in the windowless room to tell her whether it was night or day, but Maggie couldn't imagine that the night was over yet. Mo was sitting near the door with Eleanor. They both looked tired and anxious, and they were talking in low voices.
Yes, they still think I'm a magician, Mo was saying. They gave me that ridiculous name, Silver Tongue, and Capricorn is firmly convinced I can repeat the trick any time with any book at all.
And can you? Asked Eleanor. You weren't telling us the whole story earlier, were you?
Mo didn't answer for a long time.
No, he said at last. Because I don't want Maggie thinking I'm some kind of a magician, too.
So you've... well, read things out of a book quite often?
Mo nodded.
I always liked reading aloud, even as a boy, and one day when I was reading Tom Sawyer to a friend, a dead cat suddenly appeared on the carpet, lying there stiff as a board. I only noticed later that one of my soft toys had vanished. I think both our hearts missed a beat, and my friend and I swore to each other, sealing the oath with blood like Tom and Huck, that we'd never tell anyone about the cat. After that, of course, I kept trying again in secret without any witnesses, but it never seemed to happen when I wanted. In fact, there didn't seem to be any rules at all, except that it happened only with stories I liked. Of course, I kept everything that came out of the books, except for the snozcumber I got out of the book about the friendly giant. It stank too much. When Maggie was still very small, things sometimes came out of her picture books. A feather, a tiny shoe. We put them in her book box without telling her where they came from, otherwise she'd never have picked up a book again for fear the giant serpent with a toothache or some other alarming creature might appear. But I'd never managed to bring anything living out of a book, Eleanor, until that night.
Mo looked at the palms of his hands, as if seeing there all the things his voice had lured out of books.
Why couldn't it have been some nice creature if it had to happen? Something like, oh, Baba, the elephant, Maggie would have been enchanted.
Yes, I certainly would have been, thought Maggie. She remembered the little shoe and the feather as well. It had been emerald green, like the plumage of Dr. Doolittle's parrot, Polynesia.
Well, it could have been worse.
Typical Eleanor. As if it wasn't bad enough to be locked up in a tumble-down house, far away from ordinary life, surrounded by black-clad men with faces like birds of prey and knives in their belts. But obviously, Eleanor really could imagine something worse.
Suppose Long John Silver had suddenly appeared in your living room, striking out with his wooden crutch, she whispered. I think I prefer this Capricorn after all, you know what? When we're home again, in my house, I mean, I'll give you a really nice book,
Winnie the Pooh, for instance, or maybe Where the Wild Things Are. I wouldn't really mind one of those monsters. I'll sit you down in my most comfortable armchair and make you a cup of coffee, and then you can read aloud. How about it?
Mo laughed quietly, and for a moment his face didn't look quite so careworn.
No, Eleanor, I will do no such thing, although it sounds very tempting. But I swore never to read aloud again. Who knows who might disappear next time? And perhaps there's some unpleasant character we never noticed, even in the Pooh books. Or suppose I read Pooh himself out of his book. What would he do here, without his friends and the 100-acre wood? His poor little heart would break like dust fingers.
Oh, for goodness sake!
Eleanor impatiently dismissed this idea.
How often do I have to tell you that fool has no heart?
Very well, then. Let me ask you another question, because I'd very much like to know the answer.
Eleanor lowered her voice, and Maggie had to strain her ears to make out what she was saying.
Who was this Capricorn in his own story? The villain of the piece, I suppose, but can you tell me more about him?
Maggie would have liked to know more about Capricorn, too, but Mo was suddenly not very forthcoming. All he would say was, "The less you know about him, the better." Then he fell silent. Eleanor kept at him for a while, but Mo evaded all her questions.
He simply did not seem to want to talk about Capricorn.
Maggie could see from his face that his thoughts were somewhere else entirely. At some point, Eleanor nodded off, curled up on the cold floor as if trying to keep herself warm with her own body. But Mo went on sitting there with his back against the wall. As Maggie felt herself drift off to sleep again, Mo's face stayed with her in her slumber. It emerged in her dreams, like a dark moon with figures leaping from its mouth. Living creatures, fat, thin, large, small, they hopped out and ran away in a long line. A woman, scarcely more than a shadow, was dancing on the moon's nose. And suddenly, the moon smiled. Chapter 17. The Betrayer Betrayed. Sometime near daybreak, the feeble light from the electric bulb that had helped them through the night flickered out. Mo and Eleanor were asleep near the locked door, but Maggie lay in the dark with her eyes open, feeling fear ooze out of the cold walls. She listened to Eleanor's breathing and her father's, and more than anything wished for a candle and a book to keep the fear away. It seemed to be everywhere, a malicious, disembodied creature that had just been waiting for the light to go out so it could steal close to her in the darkness and take her in its cold arms. Maggie sat up, fought for breath, and crawled over to Mo on all fours. She curled up in a ball beside him the way she used to when she was little, and waited for the light of dawn to come in under the door. With the light came two of Capricorn's men. Mo had only just sat up wearily, and Eleanor was rubbing her aching back and muttering crossly when they heard the footsteps. They weren't Buster's footsteps. One of the two men, a great tall beanpole, looked as if a giant had pressed his face flat with his thumb. The other was small and thin with a goatee beard on his receding chin. He kept fiddling with his shotgun and glowering unpleasantly at the three of them as if he felt like shooting them on the spot.
"Come on, then. Get a move on," he snapped as they stumbled out into the bright light of day, blinking.
Maggie tried to remember whether his voice was one of those she had heard in Eleanor's library, but she wasn't sure. Capricorn had many men. It was a fine, warm morning. The sky arched blue and cloudless above Capricorn's village, and a couple of finches were twittering in a rose bush growing wild among the old houses, as if there were no danger in the world but a hungry cat or two. Mo took Maggie's arm as they stepped outside. Eleanor had to get her shoes on first. And when the man with the goatee tried hauling her roughly out because she didn't move fast enough for him, she pushed his hands away and fired a volley of bad language at him. That simply made the two men laugh.
whereupon Eleanor tightened her lips and confined herself to hostile glances. Capricorn's men were in a hurry. They led Mo, Meggie, and Eleanor back the way Buster had brought them the night before. The flat-faced man went ahead of them, and the man with the goatee brought up the rear, shotgun at the ready. He dragged one leg as he walked, but nonetheless he kept urging them on, as if to prove he could move faster than they could, even though he limped. Even by day, Capricorn's village appeared curiously deserted, and not just because of the many empty houses, which looked even more dismal in the sunlight. There was hardly anyone to be seen in the narrow alleys, only a few of the black jackets, as Meggie had secretly dubbed them, with skinny boys following them like puppies. Meggie only twice saw a woman passing in a hurry. She could see no children playing or running after their mothers, only cats. Black, white, ginger, tortoiseshell, tabby cats lying in the warm sun on top of walls, in doorways, on lintels. It was deathly quiet among the houses of Capricorn's village, and everything that went on seemed to be done in secret. Only the men with the guns didn't hide. They hung around together in gateways and at the corners of buildings, leaning lovingly on their weapons as they talked. There were no flowers outside the houses, like the flowers Meggie had seen in the towns and villages all along the coast. Instead, roofs had fallen in, and wild bushes were in bloom, growing out through glassless windows. Some shrubs were so heavy with scent that they made Meggie feel dizzy. When they reached the square outside the church, Meggie thought the two men were taking them to Capricorn's house again, but they passed it on their left and went straight to the big church door. The tower of the church looked as if wind and weather had been wearing the masonry down for a dangerously long time. A rusty bell hung under the pointed roof, and barely a meter lower down, a seed carried by the wind had grown into a stunted tree that now clung to the sand-coloured stone. There were eyes painted on the church door, narrow, red eyes, and ugly stone demons the height of a man stood on either side of the entrance, their teeth bared like savage dogs. "Welcome to the devil's house," said the bearded man with a mocking bow before opening the heavy door. "Don't do that, Cockerel," the flat-faced man snapped at him, spitting three times on the dusty paving stones at his feet. "It's bad luck." The man with the goatee just laughed and patted the fat belly of one of the stone figures. "Oh, come on, flat-nose, you're almost as bad as Buster. Carry on like this and you'll be hanging a stinking rabbit's foot around your own neck, too." "I like to be on the safe side," growled Flat-nose. "You hear strange tales."
"Yes, and who made them up? We did, you fool."
"Some of them date from before our time." "Whatever happens," Mo whispered to Eleanor and Meggie as the two men argued, "leave the talking to me. A sharp tongue can be dangerous here, believe me. Buster is quick to draw his knife, and he'll use it, too."
"Buster's not the only one here with a knife, Silvertongue," said Cockerel, pushing Mo into the dark church.
Meggie hurried after him. It was dim and chilly inside the church. The morning light made its way only through a few windows, painting pale patches high up on the walls and columns. No doubt these had once been grey, like the flagstones on the floor, but now there was only one colour in Capricorn's church. Everything was red. The walls, the columns, even the ceiling were vermilion, the colour of raw meat or dried blood. For a moment, Meggie felt as if she had stepped into the belly of some monster. In a corner near the entrance stood the statue of an angel. A wing was broken off, and the black jacket of one of Capricorn's men had been hung over the other wing, while someone had stuck a pair of fancy-dress horns on her head, the kind children wear to parties. Her halo was still there between them. The angel had probably once stood on the stone plinth in front of the first column. Now she had had to give way to another statue, whose gaunt, waxen face seemed to look down at Meggie with a supercilious expression. Whoever had carved it wasn't very good at his trade.
Its features were painted like the face of a plastic doll, with oddly red lips and blue eyes that held none of the cold detachment that the colourless eyes of the real Capricorn turned on the world. But to make up for that, the statue was at least twice the height of its living model, and all who passed it had to tilt back their heads to look up at its pale face.
"Is that allowed, Mo?" asked Maggie quietly, "putting up a statue of yourself in a church?"
"Oh, it's a very old custom," Eleanor whispered back. "Statues in churches aren't often the statues of saints. Most saints couldn't have paid the sculptor. In the cathedral of..."
Cockrell prodded her in the back so roughly that she stumbled forward.
"Get a move on," he growled, "and bow next time you pass him, understand?"
"Bow?"
Eleanor was going to stand her ground, but Mo quickly made her go on.
"Who on earth can take this circus seriously?" she said crossly. "If you don't keep your mouth shut," Mo told her in a whisper, "you'll soon find out how seriously they take everything here."
Eleanor looked at the scratch on his forehead and said no more. Capricorn's church contained no pews of the kind Maggie had seen in other churches, just two long wooden tables with benches, one on each side of the nave. There were dirty plates on them, coffee-stained mugs, wooden boards where cheese rinds lay, knives, sausages, empty bread baskets. Several women were busy clearing all this away. Without pausing in their work, they glanced up as Cockrell and Flatnose passed with their three captives. Maggie thought they looked like birds, hunching their heads down beneath their wings in case someone might knock them off. Not only were the pews missing from Capricorn's church, but the altar had gone too. In its place there now stood a massive chair, upholstered in red and with designs carved thickly into its legs and arms. Leading up to it were four shallow steps, carpeted in black. Maggie wasn't sure why she counted them, and, crouching on the top step, just a few paces away from the chair, his sandy hair ruffled as usual, was Dustfinger, apparently lost in thought as he let Gwyn run up and down his outstretched arm. As Maggie came down the nave with Mo and Eleanor, Dustfinger raised his head briefly. Gwyn climbed up to his shoulder, baring his tiny teeth, sharp as splinters of glass, as if he had recognized the hatred in Maggie's eyes as they rested on his master. Now she knew why the marten had horns, and why his twin was shown on the page of a book. She understood it all. Why Dustfinger thought the world was too fast and too noisy, why he didn't understand cars and often looked as if he was somewhere else entirely. But she felt none of the sympathy Mo had shown for him. His scarred face only reminded her of the lies he had told to lure her out to him, like the Pied Piper in the story. He had played with her as he played with fire, with his brightly coloured juggler's balls. "Come along, Maggie, this way, Maggie, trust me, Maggie." She felt like running up the steps and striking his lying mouth. Dustfinger must have guessed her thoughts and was avoiding her eyes. Not looking at Mo and Eleanor either, he put a hand in his pants pocket and brought out a matchbox. As if unconscious of what he was doing, he took out a match, lit it, and gazed at the flame, lost in thought, as he passed a finger through it almost caressingly until it singed his fingertip. Maggie looked away. She didn't want to see him. She wanted to forget he was there. To her left, at the foot of the steps, stood two drum-shaped iron braziers, rusty brown with wood heaped up in them, pale, freshly cut firewood, log upon log. Maggie was just wondering what the wood was for when more steps echoed through the church. Buster was walking down the nave with a gas can in his hand. Reluctantly, Cockrell and Flatnose gave way as he pushed past them.
"Ah, so Dustfinger's playing with his best friend again," he sneered as he climbed the shallow steps.
Dustfinger lowered the matchstick and straightened up.
"Here you are," said Buster, putting the gas can down at his feet. "Another toy for you. Light us a fire, that's what you like best."
Dustfinger threw away the spent match and lit another.
"So how about you?" he asked quietly, raising the burning match to Buster's face. "Still afraid of fire, are you?"
Buster knocked the match out of his hand.
"Oh, you shouldn't do that," said Dustfinger. "It means bad luck. You know how quickly fire takes offense."
For a moment, Maggie thought Buster was going to hit him, and she wasn't the only one. All eyes were turned on the two men. But something seemed to protect Dustfinger. Perhaps it really was the fire.
"You're lucky I just cleaned my knife," spat Buster. "One more trick like that, though, and I'll carve a few nice new patterns on your ugly face and make myself a fur collar out of your Martin."
Gwyn uttered a soft, threatening snarl and wrapped himself around Dustfinger's neck.
Dustfinger bent, picked up the spent matches, and put them back in the matchbox.
"Yes, I'm sure you'd enjoy that," he said, still without looking at Buster. "But why would I want to light a fire just now, I wonder?"
"Never you mind that. Just do it. Then the rest of us can keep it fed. But make sure it's a large, hungry blaze, not one of your tame little fires you like to play with."
Dustfinger picked up the gas can and slowly climbed down the steps. He was standing beside the rusty braziers when the church door opened for the second time. Maggie turned at the sound of the heavy wooden door creaking and saw Capricorn appear between the red columns. He glanced at his statue as if to make sure it still gave a flattering enough image of him, then strode quickly down the nave. He was wearing a suit as red as the church walls. Only the shirt beneath it was black, and he had a black feather in his buttonhole. A good half dozen of his men were following him, like crows following a peacock. Their steps seemed to echo all the way up to the ceiling. Maggie reached for Mo's hand.
"Ah, so our guests are here already," said Capricorn, stopping in front of them. "Did you sleep well, Silvertongue?"
He had curiously soft, curving, almost feminine lips, and as he spoke he kept running his little finger along them as if to retrace them. They were as bloodless as the rest of his face.
"Wasn't it kind of me to reunite you with your little girl last night? At first I meant it to be a surprise present for you today, but then I thought, Capricorn, you really owe that child something for bringing you what you've wanted so long, and of her own free will, too."
He was holding Inkheart. Maggie saw Mo's gaze linger on the book. Capricorn was a tall man, but Mo stood a few centimetres taller, which obviously displeased Capricorn. He stood very upright, as if that would make up for the difference.
"Let Eleanor take my daughter home with her," said Mo. "Let them go, and I'll try to read you back again. I'll read you anything you like, but let the two of them go first."
What was he talking about? Maggie looked at him in horror. "No," she said. "No, Mo, I don't want to go away." But no one was paying any attention to her.
"Let them go?"
Capricorn turned to his men.
"Hear that? Why would I do such a crazy thing now that they're here?"
The men laughed, but Capricorn turned to Mo again.
"You know as well as I do that from now on you'll do whatever I want," he said. "Now that she's here, I'm sure you won't go on denying us a demonstration of your skill."
Mo squeezed Maggie's hand so hard her fingers hurt.
"And as for this book,"
said Capricorn, looking at Inkheart with as much dislike as if it had bitten his pale fingers,
"this extremely tedious, stupid, and extraordinarily long-winded book, I can assure you I have no intention of ever again letting myself be spellbound by its story. All those troublesome creatures, those fluttering fairies with their twittering voices, the swarming, scrabbling, stupid beasts everywhere, the smell of fur and dung. All through this book you kept falling over bandy-legged goblins in the marketplace, and when you went hunting the giants scared the game away with their huge feet, talking trees, whispering pools. Was there anything in that world that didn't have the power of speech? And then those endless muddy roads to the nearest town, if it could be called a town, that pack of well-born, finely dressed princes in their castles, those stinking peasants so poor there was nothing to be gotten out of them, and the vagabonds and beggars with vermin dropping from their hair. Oh, how sick I was of them all.
Capricorn made a sign, and one of his men brought in a large cardboard box. You could see from the way he carried it that it was very heavy. The man put it down on the grey flagstones in front of Capricorn with a sigh of relief. Capricorn handed Cockerell, who was standing beside him, the book that Mo had kept from him for so long, and bent to open the box. It was full to the brim with books.
"It's been a great deal of trouble finding them all," said Capricorn as he reached into the box and took out two books. "They may look different, but the contents are the same. The fact that the story has been printed in several languages made the search even more difficult, a particularly useless feature of this world, all those different languages. It was simpler in our own world, wasn't it, Dustfinger?"
Dustfinger made no answer. He stood there holding the gas can and staring at the box. Capricorn strolled over to him and threw the two books into one of the braziers.
"What are you doing?"
Dustfinger tried to snatch them out, but Buster pushed him away.
"Those stay where they are," he growled.
Dustfinger stepped back, holding the can behind his back, but Buster grabbed it from his hands.
"Why, it looks as if our fire-eater would rather let someone else light the fire today," he mocked.
Dustfinger cast him a glance full of hatred. Face rigid, he watched Capricorn's men throw more and more books into the braziers. In the end there were more than 2 dozen copies of Inkheart on the piles of firewood, their pages crumpled, their bindings wrenched apart like broken wings.
"You know what always got me down back in our old world, Dustfinger?"
asked Capricorn as he took the gas can from Buster's hand.
"The difficulty of lighting a fire. It wasn't any problem for you, of course. You could even talk to fire. Very likely one of those grunting goblins taught you how. But it was a tedious business for the rest of us. The wood was always damp, or the wind blew down the chimney. I know you long for the good old days. You miss all your chirping, fluttering friends. But I don't shed a tear for any of that. This world is far better equipped than the one we had to be content with for so many long years."
Dustfinger did not seem to hear a word of what Capricorn was saying. He just stared at the gasoline and smelled its fumes as it was poured over the books. The pages sucked it up as greedily as if they were welcoming their own end.
"Where did they all come from?"
he stammered.
"You always told me there was just one copy left, Silvertongue's." "Yes, yes. I told you all kinds of things."
Capricorn put his hand in his pants pocket.
"You're such a gullible fellow, Dustfinger. It's fun to tell you lies. Your innocence always amazed me. After all, you lie very cleverly yourself. But you're too ready to believe what you want to believe. That's your trouble." "Well, you can safely believe me now. These," he said, tapping the gasoline-soaked pile of books, "these really are the last copies of our ink-black home. It's taken Buster and the others years to track them all down in shabby lending libraries and second-hand bookshops."
Dustfinger looked longingly at the books as a man dying of thirst might look at the last glass of water in existence.
"But you can't burn them," he stammered. "You promised to send me back if I found you Silvertongue's book. That's why I told you where he was. That's why I brought you his daughter."
Capricorn merely shrugged his shoulders. and took the book from Cockerell's hands, the book with the green binding that Maggie and Eleanor had been so eager to give him, the book for which he had made his men bring Mo all this way, the book for which Dustfinger had betrayed them all.
"I'd have promised to fetch you down the moon from the sky if that would have done me any good," said Capricorn, looking bored as he flung the last copy of Inkheart onto the pile with its companions. "I'm happy to make promises, especially promises I can't keep."
Then he took a lighter from his pocket. Dustfinger was about to leap at him to strike it out of his hand, but Capricorn made a sign to Flatnose. Flatnose was so tall and broad that beside him Dustfinger looked almost like a child, and, indeed, the man took hold of him as if he were a badly behaved little boy. Fur bristling, Gwyn leapt off Dustfinger's shoulders. One of Capricorn's men kicked out as the marten shot past his legs, but Gwyn got away and disappeared behind one of the red columns. The other men stood there laughing at Dustfinger's desperate attempts to free himself from Flatnose's iron grasp. Flatnose thought it greatly amusing to let Dustfinger get just close enough to the gas-soaked books to touch the top volumes with his fingers. Such malice made Maggie feel quite ill. Mo took a step forward as if to go to Dustfinger's aid, but Buster barred his way, a knife in his hand. Its blade, narrow and shiny, looked terribly sharp held against Mo's throat. Eleanor screamed and directed a torrent of curses at Buster that Maggie had never even heard before, but she herself could not move. She just stood there in numb and silent terror, staring at the blade against Mo's bare throat.
"Let me have one of them, Capricorn, just one," Mo cried,
and only then did Maggie realize that he had not been going to help Dustfinger, but was thinking of the book.
"I promise never to read aloud a line of it that mentions your name." "You, are you mad? You're the last man I'd give one to," replied Capricorn. "One day you might be unable to control your tongue after all, and I'd land back in that ridiculous story again. No, thank you very much." "Nonsense," cried Mo. "I couldn't read you back into it, even if I wanted to. How often do I have to tell you that? Ask Dustfinger. I've explained it to him 1,000 times. I myself don't understand how or when these things happen. For heaven's sake, believe me."
With a chilling smirk, Capricorn answered merely with a smile.
"I'm sorry, Silvertongue, but the fact is I don't believe anyone. You ought to know that by now. We're all liars when it serves our purpose."
And with those words, he flicked the lighter and held its flame to one of the books. The gasoline had made the pages almost transparent, like parchment, and they flared up at once. Even the stout cloth bindings caught light immediately, the linen turning black as the flames licked around it. When the third book caught fire, Dustfinger kicked Flatnose's kneecap so hard the man screamed with pain and let go of him. Nimble as his marten, Dustfinger wriggled out of those powerful arms and stumbled toward the braziers. Without hesitating, he reached into the flames, but the book he plucked out was already burning like a torch. Dustfinger dropped it on the flagstone floor and reached into the fire again with his other hand this time, but by this time Flatnose had already grasped him by the collar and was shaking him so roughly that Dustfinger was gasping for air.
"Look at the lunatic," sneered Buster as Dustfinger stared at his hands, his face distorted with pain. "Can anyone explain what he wants so much? Maybe those ugly goblin girls who thought him so wonderful when he juggled in the marketplace, or the filthy hovels where he lived with other vagabonds. They smelled even worse than the backpack he carries that stinking marten around in."
Capricorn's men laughed as the books slowly crumpled into ashes. There was still a smell of gasoline in the church, such an acrid smell that it made Maggie cough. Mo put a protective arm around her shoulders, as if Buster had threatened her rather than him. But who, thought Maggie, who could protect Mo? Eleanor was looking at his neck as anxiously as if she feared Buster's knife may have left its mark there after all.
"These fellows are out of their minds," she whispered. "You know what they say, when people start burning books, they'll soon burn human beings. Suppose we're next to find ourselves on a pyre."
Buster seemed to hear what she was saying. He caught her eye, and with a twisted smile, kissed the blade of his knife. Eleanor fell silent, as if she had swallowed her tongue. Capricorn had taken a snow-white handkerchief from his pocket. He cleaned his fingers with it carefully, as if to wipe even the memory of Inkheart off his hands.
"Well, that's done at last," he remarked with a final nod at the smoking embers.
Then, with a satisfied expression on his face, he climbed up to the chair that had replaced the altar. Capricorn sank into its red upholstery with a deep sigh.
"Dustfinger, go to the kitchen and get Mortula to put something on your burns," he ordered in a commanding voice. "You'll be no use for anything without the use of your hands."
Dustfinger looked at Mo for a long time before obeying this order. Head bent, with unsteady steps, he walked past Capricorn's men. The way to the church porch seemed endless. For a moment, as Dustfinger opened the door, bright sunlight shone into the building. As it closed behind him, Maggie, Mo, and Eleanor were left with Capricorn and his men, and the reek of gas and burnt paper.
"And now let's come to you, Silvertongue," said Capricorn, stretching his legs.
He was wearing black boots. He examined the gleaming leather with satisfaction, removing a scrap of charred paper from the toe of one boot.
"Until now, I, Buster, and the unfortunate Dustfinger are the only evidence that you can conjure up extraordinary magic out of little black letters. You yourself don't seem to trust your gift, if we're to believe you, which, as I was saying just now, I don't. On the contrary, I think you are a master of your craft, and I can scarcely wait for you to give us another taste of your skill at long last. Cockerel!" His voice sounded irritated. "Where's the reader? Didn't I tell you to bring him?"
Cockerel stroked his beard nervously.
"He was still busy choosing books," he stammered. "I'll get him right away."
And with a hasty bow, he limped off. Capricorn began drumming his fingers on the arms of his chair.
"No doubt you've already heard that I had to resort to the services of another reader while you were hiding from me so successfully," he said to Mo. "I found him by chance 5 years ago, but he's useless. You only have to look at Flatnose's face."
Flatnose lowered his head, embarrassed, when all eyes turned on him.
"And Cockerel owes him his limp, too. As for the girls he read out of his books for me, you should have seen them. It'd give a man nightmares just to see their faces. Finally, I had him read to me only when I felt like amusing myself with his monsters, and I actually found my men in this world of yours just by recruiting them when they were still young. There's a lonely boy who likes to play with fire in almost every village."
Smiling, he inspected his fingernails like a satisfied cat examining its claws.
"I've told the reader to find the right books for you. At least the poor fool does know his way around books. He lives in them like one of those pale worms that feed on paper. And just what am I supposed to read out of his books for you?"
Moe's voice sounded bitter.
"A few monsters? A couple of human horrors to suit the present company?"
He nodded in Buster's direction.
"For heaven's sake, Mortimer, don't put ideas into his head," whispered Eleanor with a nervous glance at Capricorn.
But Capricorn merely flicked some ash off his pants and smiled.
"No, thank you, Silvertongue," he said. "I have enough men, and as for the monsters, well, perhaps we'll get around to them later. For the time being, we're doing very well with Buster's trained dogs and the local snakes. They make excellent and deadly presents. No, Silvertongue, all I want today, as a test of your skill, is gold. I have such an appetite for money. My men do their best to squeeze all that can be squeezed out of this part of the country." At these words from Capricorn, Buster lovingly stroked his knife. "But it's never enough for all the wonderful things that can be bought in this infinitely wide world of yours. A world of so many pages, Silvertongue, so very many pages, and I want to write my name on every one of them."
"In what kind of letters?" inquired Mo. "Is Buster going to scratch them into the paper with his knife?"
"Oh, Buster can't write," replied Capricorn calmly. "None of my men can either read or write. I've forbidden them to learn. But I've got one of my maidservants to teach me how to read, and when there's something to be written, the reader does it. So you see, my dear Silvertongue, I can make my mark on your world."
The church door opened as if Cockerell had just been waiting for this cue. The man he ushered in had his head hunched between his shoulders and looked neither right nor left as he followed Cockerell. He was small and thin, and couldn't be any older than Mo, but his back was bent like an old man's, and his arms and legs moved awkwardly, as if he didn't quite know what to do with them. He kept nervously adjusting his glasses. The frame was held together over the bridge of his nose with sticky tape, as if it had often been broken. He was clutching a number of books to his chest with his left arm, as if they offered some protection from the stares turned on him from all sides, and the sinister place to which he had been brought. When the two men eventually reached the foot of the steps, Cockerell dug an elbow into his companion's ribs, and the man bowed so hurriedly that two of the books fell to the floor. He was quick to snatch them up and bowed to Capricorn a second time.
"We've been waiting for you, Darius," said Capricorn. "I trust you found what I wanted."
"Oh, yes, yes," stammered
Darius, casting an almost reverent glance at Mo.
"Is that him?"
"Yes, show him the books you've chosen."
Darius nodded and bowed again, this time to Mo.
These are all stories with treasure in them," he stammered. "Finding them wasn't as easy as I'd expected," he added with the faintest note of reproach in his voice. "After all, there aren't so many books in this village. And however often I ask, no one brings me any more, or if they do, the books are useless. But never mind that. Here they are. I think you'll be happy with my choice anyway."
He knelt down on the floor in front of Mo and began setting out the books side by side so Mo could read the titles. The very first one alarmed Maggie. Treasure Island. She looked uneasily at Mo. "Not that one," she thought. "Not that book, Mo." But Mo had already picked up another book, Tales from the Thousand and One Nights.
"I think this will do," he said. "There's sure to be plenty of gold in those stories, but I'm warning you again. I don't know what will happen, because it never does happen when I want it to. I know you all think I'm a magician, but I'm not. The magic comes out of the books themselves, and I have no more idea than you or any of your men how it works."
Capricorn leaned back in his chair, looking expressionlessly at Mo.
"How many more times are you going to tell me that, Silvertongue?" he asked in bored tones. "You can say so as often as you like, but I don't believe it. In the world on which we finally slammed the door today, I frequently mingled with magicians, wizards, and witches, and I very often had to deal with their obstinacy. I know that Basta has given you a graphic account of the way we used to break their will. But in your case, and now that your daughter is here as our guest, I'm sure such painful methods will not be necessary."
With these words, Capricorn looked pointedly at Basta. Mo tried to hold on to Maggie, but Basta moved faster. Pulling her toward him, he quickly put an arm around her neck and held her in a headlock.
"From now on, Silvertongue," continued Capricorn, his voice still sounding as indifferent as if he were talking about the weather, "from now on,
Basta will be your daughter's personal shadow. This will provide her with reliable protection from snakes and fierce dogs, but not, of course, from Basta himself, who will be kind to her only as long as I say so. And that, in turn, will depend on whether I am pleased with your services. Have I made myself clear? Mo looked first at him, and then at Maggie. She did her best to look unafraid, so that he would think there was no need to worry about her.